Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, happy to welcome to the program today for the first time from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Robson Giglio. He is a clinical assistant professor of diagnostic imaging, and we're going to get an overview of diagnostic imaging again, and then we're going to talk about a really fun topic, and that is canine sports medicine, dogs that do, say, agility training, and the kind of injuries and circumstances that might lead them to need diagnostic imaging. And then towards the end of the program, we're going to touch on some exotic species as well. I hope you'll stay tuned. Animal Airwaves Live is coming up after this news from NPR. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm really happy to welcome to the program today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Robson Giglio, and we're going to be continuing part of our ongoing series on this show devoted to the topic of diagnostic imaging. And we're going to talk about a couple of things we haven't spoken about before, though, in regards to diagnostic imaging. We're going to be talking about sports medicine, as well as some exotic animals, too, and how they receive diagnostic imaging and under what conditions and what for. And so first, let me welcome you to the program, Dr. Giglio. I'm really glad to have you here. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's have a brief overview, if we can, about diagnostic imaging and kind of what modalities are available today to the veterinarian.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. So in diagnostic imaging, we work with five modalities, which are radiography, ultrasound, computer tomography, magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, and nuclear medicine, which is also called scintigraphy. So these are the five main modalities, but in research, we do some other, we can use some other modalities that fuse some of these previous modalities that I already spoke about. And so basically, like in our hospital for clinical patients, we're going to have radiography, ultrasound, CT, MRI, and nuclear medicine.
So one of the best known of all these diagnostic imaging modalities is one of the oldest as well, and that's radiography. Can we talk just briefly about radiography, which I think people know pretty well from their own sort of experiences in human medicine?
Mm-hmm. So radiography is the first front of the diagnostic imaging. So usually is the cheapest exam that we have and can provide a nice overview about the region that we're studying on the patients, the region that we have questions. So basically, it's a form of radiation that we give to the animals, just like for us. So we have a protected room, and we allow just few people or the least amount of people inside the room to not be exposed to radiation. So basically, the X-rays, they travel through the body or the region of the patient, and then you're going to impregnate in either like a imaging plate or a radiographic film, and then we can see the structures from inside of the patient. So basically, it's really nice to evaluate the thorax or the chest of the animal, and also to evaluate the limbs or the hands, the feet, and stiff knees and hips, stuff like that. But you use for everything because, like I said, is the most common one and is the first diagnostic image modality that we use to have an overall view of what's going on. And then further, if we need some other tests, we may do a combination of tests.
Okay, so X-rays we know from our own experiences, either at the dentist's office or if we were little and we broke a bone, or you know, any time in our life that maybe something needs to be diagnosed, and our pets can get it too. I mean, if your pet has suffered some kind of injury and maybe you suspect a broken limb or something, a radiograph would probably be a really good way to look for that, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Not just like broken limbs, but one very common thing that also on us and human patients to look for pneumonia. So we do a lot of radiographs of the chest, and we look for evidence of enlargement of the heart and stuff like that too.
The film radiographs that people are used to seeing, the kind that a doctor or veterinarian would put up on a light box on the wall, those have kind of been phased out, right? And you're using digital technology now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Since, like, I've been working with radiographs for more than 10 years now. And I remember when I was doing my vet school, we used to have analog radiographs, and a little bit after when I graduated. But since the last, especially here in America, the last 10 years at least, in several places, we use digital radiograph. And now in the last few, 3 or 4 years, I believe, we start to use a new modality of digital radiograph, which is faster, which is called direct digital radiograph, instead of computer radiograph that we had before. So it's a faster way to produce images, and we get also images with better quality.
So when you say it's faster, I mean, you have an image in within minutes?
Oh, within seconds, because it's in some places, and we have in our large animals, so for horses and cows and stuff like that, we have a wireless plate, and also for our small animals. So we can take radiograph, and then from the image plate, the information is transferred to your computer screen in just a matter of seconds using this digital direct digital radiograph. Using the prior system, which is also considered a digital radiograph, but it's called CR, or that stands for computer radiograph, we must have an intermediate step to process this digital image. With the direct digital radiograph, we don't have this intermediate step. So just seconds after you press the button and get the image, you're going to see the image in the screen of the computer.
Tell me about the monitors or computer screens that you use to look at some of these diagnostic images. This may not even just be for radiographs, but maybe some of the other modalities as well. Are they pretty high resolution screens that you're looking on, so you can get at some fine detail?
Mm-hmm, exactly. So we, on our workstations there in the reading room, they're all, it's just like the human part. So we have digital monitors that are specifically designed to read radiographs. So usually they are just in shades of gray, so they are not color monitors, and they have a really nice resolution, and unfortunately, they're much more expensive than the regular monitors. So with those, we can zoom in these images, and also we have several other tools that we can better see the details of the image and interpret it in the most correct manner.
So we have radiographs. What was probably, maybe let's say, the second most common modality that might be used for an animal?
So the second most common, I would say, is ultrasound, mainly for abdomen. So we use a lot of computer tomography that is an excellent image modality and is also super fast. But each modality, you're going to provide a type of information. None of the modalities, they substitute one or the other. So each modality, sometimes you can have similar information coming from one modality and the other. But usually, like, all the modalities are going to be complementary to each other. And then depending on the clinical case, you use one or other, or maybe two or three modalities. So in ultrasound, we usually use for abdomen. So I think more than 90% of the caseload on ultrasound are abdominal ultrasound. So we're going to see the organs inside the belly of the animal. So we we can see with detail liver, spleen, kidneys, even adrenal glands, small structures. So the adrenal glands, we can follow vessels and see basically all the organs inside the abdomen. And also, like, in the last few years, especially developing the other portions of veterinary medicine, we are using the ultrasound to see another structures. So we are using the ultrasound to check the back of the eye in ophthalmologic cases. So sometimes we have some disease that block the view of the back of the eye. So we need to use the ultrasound to see the retina and adjacent structures. And other stuff that we usually, other regions that we usually use the ultrasound is the neck. So we can evaluate the thyroid gland and the parathyroid gland. So this is similar to humans too, that we see frequently the exam of the cervical region or the neck. And also for sports dogs and dogs with musculoskeletal disease, we've been doing more and more ultrasound of the shoulder joints to look for lesions in the tendons and ligaments, and also stifle joints in hock and stuff like that. So in horses, it's a little bit different because like horses have a huge belly. So we see more the peripheral structures in the abdomen, but not much the deep structures. And in horses, it's much more well-developed, the ultrasonographic exam of the limbs, the extremities of the horse. So it's in horses, the musculoskeletal exam would be the most common one that we do via ultrasound.
With ultrasound, are we also talking here about a black and white image?
Yeah, so not all the image modalities, but the majority of them, they're all shades of gray. And the ultrasound, the image formation of the ultrasound is a little bit different. So it's not X-ray, so it's not ionized radiation. So what we use is sound. So sound that we cannot hear. It's beyond our hearing. So what happens is the probe or the transducer that we put in contact with the animal, it's going to emit sound, and then the sound that is going to be reflected from the different regions inside the body, it's going to produce an image for us, and some structures that are more reflective and some structures are less reflective. So this difference we're going to show in the screen in shades of gray.
With an ultrasound, are we talking about an image that is kind of a live image? That is to say, you're seeing inside what's happening right then. And as you move the probe, the image changes. So it requires a kind of a well-guided hand to administer an ultrasound. And also, as you're looking for things, you're seeing the actions of the internal body as the image is taking place on the screen.
Yes, perfect. So this is one of the advantages of ultrasound in comparison to the other modalities, is that can we do like a real-time exam. So we can see the contraction of the intestines, the peristalsis. We can see the movement of blood inside the arteries and the veins. So in this information, it's the best modality to evaluate dynamic lesions. And actually on ultrasound, besides the traditional shades of gray, we can use some Doppler techniques. There are techniques that we can evaluate the velocity of moving structures inside the screen. So we use this to evaluate the blood flow inside the vessels. And with this modality, actually we put some colors on that we can see if this movement of the blood flow is coming to one direction or the other. And this we can produce like color images, but overall, just coming back to the last topic, overall our images are all black and white.
Now you just mentioned Doppler as it relates to imaging, and this brings up the whole idea that diagnostic imaging is in a major way of a kind of medical specialty that involves a great deal of physics, right? Mm-hmm. You've got to know a lot about the science behind this. I mean, you mentioned Doppler, and I think our listeners might know Doppler more from the way we hear sound. For instance, the famous example is, let's say you're standing on the corner and a police car goes by. Mm-hmm. As it approaches, you hear the siren at a pitch that then appears to go down in pitch as it passes you by. And that is because as the car is approaching you, the waves of sound are shorter. And then as it moves away from you, I believe the waves of sound are longer. I imagine that is not terribly dissimilar to what you're experiencing in diagnostic imaging, right? And allows you to see some movement.
Yeah, exactly. So that's how we can detect the how the blood flow is moving, because when something a red blood cell is moving towards our transducer, the frequency is gonna have a it's going to appear that the frequency is higher and the sound is higher. And then when these red blood cells are moving away from your transducer, so the frequency is going to appear to be decreased and the sound is going to fade away. So this is exactly, it's pure physics. And in our boards, we have to study physics. And same for the human radiologist. Actually, here in UF, we have the pleasure to have a physics review with everybody from the radiology residents from the human hospital and the dentistry residents too. So we need to know a lot of physics to try to optimize the image and optimize, of course, the diagnosis.
And to keep everyone safe too, because when we were talking a little while ago about radiographs, there is a potential, albeit small, risk for folks who do radiographs a lot. So maybe technicians who are administering radiographs a lot over time, you know, they could potentially, if safety measures aren't taken, they mm-hmm. could be exposed to potentially harmful levels of radiation. But you are all trained to protect yourselves, correct?
Mm-hmm, exactly. So in the floor, we try to be near to the animal as least as we can. So that's why sometimes we need to sedate the animals. And then we use also troughs and we use tapes to try to restrain the animal and position the animal without somebody there to hold. So this is very important because people, and when you are there inside, when we have to be there, we are all using radiation protection. So we are with a lead apron, and then we have thyroid shields, and then we have glasses too. So, and then we make sure that we protect against all the secondary scatter radiation that we call that is going to bounce from the patients all over the room. So this is a concern that we have to be always on our mind. Especially we use a lot on radiograph, but especially in CT, that the dose of radiation is higher. We have to be concerned about the dose that the patient is going to get, and this is a concern. A major concern in human medicine, because besides we do our exam to diagnose, we do a lot of rechecks. So sometimes a human patient, they may do several CT exams and then their radiation dose is going to be higher. But for veterinary patients, usually we don't do that frequently, the rechecks. And so it's not a huge problem in veterinary medicine so far, but maybe in the future it will be when you do a lot of rechecks. And one other thing that we use to protect ourselves is a tool called dosimeter. So it's going to measure the radiation that we get over the month. So everybody in the floor, even if you're not holding the animal or don't have direct contact with the patients, we use a dosimeter that is, and then we get a reading number monthly. So we know your radiation exposure that we have. And if you have higher numbers, you have to put to be out of the floor.
You mentioned CT. That's another modality. Tell us a little bit about how CT works.
Mm-hmm. So CT is similar to radiographs in a way that we use ionized radiation. So CT is going to produce an X-ray. But the major advantage of CT is that we see images, we see just like slice of bread. So the patient, the human patient, or the dog, the cat, the horse, they're going to be put on a table. And then the CT machine is gonna the table is gonna get inside, and then the CT machine is gonna produce X-rays 360 degrees around the patient. So this will provide us to get very, very thin slices of any part of the patient. And the major advantage from radiographs is that we don't have superimposition of any structure in the structure of interest because we have very thin slices. So, for example, when we are doing a radiograph and we're going to try to look for lesions in the lungs, we have always the superimposition of the ribs. So the ribs are going to be always in the way. And then when you do CT, because we have these very thin slices that we can reconstruct in any plane that we want, we won't have the superimposition. And besides of this, we can use a technique called windowing the image, that we can select the brightness and contrast of the image and select for different ranges, because the machine can produce like much more shades of gray than our human eye can appreciate or differentiate. So basically, we narrow down the shades of gray that we can see, and the machine is going to display in different shades of gray for each specific region. So we can use a lung window to see the lungs. So in that specific window, you're going to see pretty well the lungs, but we won't see anything like that is more opaque or more dense than the lungs, such as the soft tissue surrounding the ribs or any osseous structure. And then we have the lung, the bone window that we're going to see with a really nice detail, the bone, but the lungs, they're going to be all black with no information whatsoever. In this, we can do the same thing for the brain, and we can do, and you have a special window for soft tissues and so forth. So this the four major windows that we have are lung, soft tissue, brain, and lungs, soft tissue, brain, and bone. So these are the most common ones, but we can use another ones depending which region we are interested in.
Now that sounds like a very, very useful modality. Finally, let's talk a bit about MRI as well. Does MRI use the same kind of radiation, or is it a different kind of process altogether?
Yeah, it's a different process altogether. So MRI uses electromagnetic radiation. So it's going to be similar to what the kind of waves that our cell phone have or your microwave have. So we use these electromagnetic waves because every molecule in our body, they have water. Sometimes we have water that is a larger quantity. For example, like in a fluid-filled cavity, like your stomach full of food or your gallbladder. And some structures have less water, such as your bones, but they have more or less water anywhere. And the water may be have tight junctions with the other elements or have more loose junctions. So basically, in the MRI, what happens, we expose the patient or the region of the body with this electromagnetic current. And then these molecules of hydrogen inside the atom of hydrogen inside the molecules of water, they're going to spin in a different way because usually like in the body, they are moving in different directions. So when you put inside the magnets, they're going to move in a specific direction. They're going to be aligned. And then you're going to give this electromagnetic current, and then they're going to change slightly the rotation, the normal rotation that they will have. And then you take this electromagnetic wave out of the equation, and then the hydrogen atoms, they're going to come back to their normal state. And then when they come back to the normal state, they're going to produce detectable energy. And this detectable energy, the machine, through a coil, which is just like an antenna, is the coil is the structure that usually you put like near the region of interest. Like, for example, if you want to do an MRI of the head, you're going to put around the head one structure that they're going to cover the area. And actually, that is an antenna. So you're going to detect this energy coming from the patient or from the region of the patient. And then this energy, they're going to come in different quantities, depends of the hydrogen or in the water inside that region. And they're going to come in different times. depending on which region they're located, if they have tight bones or more loose bones. And then you can differentiate different tissues using that. And also a diseased tissue, they're going to have, for example, when you hurt your arm, and then you're going to have more blood in that region, and then you're going to have a swelling. So in that region, you're going to have more hydrogens. So because of that, we're going to see, we can differentiate one tissue from the other and one tissue that is normal from the same tissue that is abnormal. So it's a very interesting imaging modality and is more, is commonly used to evaluate lesions in the brain and spinal cord, but is also used to evaluate musculoskeletal lesions, especially the non-osseous lesions, such as lesions in the muscle, tendons, and ligaments. So for that, we use, which is not the, like, our machines there in at the hospital, more than 90-95% of the time we use to see either the brain or the spinal cord for small animals. And the other portion is going to be to evaluate, like, shoulders, and mainly shoulders we do. And but in large animal is the opposite. So for horses, we mainly use to see the foot and the structures and adjacent structures, and we rarely use to see, for example, the brain.
So we have several different modalities that are available to veterinarians who need to do diagnostic imaging. That means that there is a vast array of different conditions, different potential problems that can be diagnosed with imaging modalities. When we come back, Dr. Giglio, I'd like to talk about some of the ways that you use diagnostic imaging to treat animals that do sports and maybe to treat some exotic animals well. I should tell our listeners, you're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, speaking with Dr. Robson Giglio from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm happy to have as my guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Robson Giglio, and we're talking about subspecialties of diagnostic imaging. Now, Dr. Giglio just gave us a really great overview of diagnostic imaging, and now we're going to get into to what some of these subspecialties are. And maybe a fun place to start, Dr. Giglio, would be to talk about the specialty of canine sports medicine. Let's talk a little about these animals and the kind of things that they do and the sort of injuries they might have that would require diagnostic imaging.
Great. So, yeah, this is one area that I really enjoy, and it's an area that is growing a lot, especially now there are canine patients are having more access of physiotherapy and rehabilitation. So this is an area that is growing a lot. And usually, like, there is a different trend because in the lesions that we see in the sports, dogs that do sports, they may differ based on the sport and the breed. But because usually, like, not all sports, they have the same breeds that go to, that have the best performance. So basically there was like a change in the last few decades. There was a change in the most popular canine sports. So in the past, I believe the one of the most common sports would be the race, the coursing, and then greyhounds would be the, and sometimes whippets, they were the most common dogs. So are dogs that have they achieve really high velocities for a short period of time. So they have some, usually they may have some specific lesions. And nowadays, there is a trend to an agility, dog agility, to grow a lot, and also flyball in other canine sports, but mainly agility now is the number one sport, not just here in America, but in the whole world. And such as, so the canine sports medicine increased a lot because of these agility dogs and flyball dogs, and also to provide rehabilitation of the canine patients that had maybe sometimes related to sport or maybe sometimes not related to sport, musculoskeletal injuries. So when we still do the rehab of these patients, I mean, when you do physiotherapy in these patients, we develop the canine sports medicine, even though sometimes they are not sporting dogs, but they may have similar lesions. So in the and I'm very proud to be, I also do agility, so I practice agility, so I'm happy to try to contribute also in this field that I like a lot, and doing using my specialty of diagnostic imaging, I can help these patients to guide to have a better treatment. So in so like I said, different breeds in different sports, they're gonna have different issues. For example, in agility, one common lesion is a lesion in the shoulder joints. So because the dogs, they put much more weight when they are jumping, and when you're doing contact obstacles, they put a lot of weight in the front limbs. And this is the most common in the shoulder joint. Actually is a joint that doesn't have a lot of, normally doesn't have a lot of coverage from the scapula into the humerus. So it's a kind of more loose joint that we have, and the animals, they do have too. So this is a joint that because of doesn't have enough osseous coverage, they have a lot of tendons and ligaments to try to keep it together. So in these structures are usually the ones that may we may see a disease on it.
And when you're trying to diagnose a problem in that part of a dog, what modality do you use, and what are you looking for? How do you find it if it's there?
Mm-hmm. So perfect. So the first thing is have like a good clinical exam. So the clinician that is doing the exam, either can be orthopedic surgeon or general practitioner, or a person that works with physiotherapy, they have to do a good clinical exam to try to see what is the region or the regions that are most suspect to be to have a lesion. Because one thing that we, and it's going to be very expensive for the owner, is try to search the whole dog for lesions. So the clinical exam is paramount for that. So when you do a good clinical exam, you're going to select a region or regions that are suspicious to be cause of the lameness, because usually is the most common cause of the sports dog to come into the veterinary clinic. And so starting from the clinical exam, you can isolate the region, and then we usually start to doing radiographs, like I said, because it's a cheaper diagnostic image modality and can provide a really nice overview about what's going on. So for example, if the clinician thought that the lesion is located in the shoulder joint, we can start to doing a radiograph of the shoulder joint to see if you see major lesions. So basically in the radiograph, you're gonna see osseous lesions. So we're gonna evaluate the bone, the articular bone, and also the bones that are involved in adjacent to the joint. This is a good thing to evaluate if you have so any evidence of arthrosis. And then this is also gonna, if the dog has a lot of degenerative changes in the shoulder joint, the problem is more likely to be chronic. And then we can do, the treatment is gonna be harder to come back to the way that it was before. But if the in the radiographs, the shoulder joint will be like near normal, it's gonna be easier to treat. But when we don't have any radiographic changes in the shoulder joint, we gotta pursue something other modality to try to investigate this better. So usually, then the second most common diagnostic imaging modality to evaluate lesions in the shoulder joint will be the ultrasound. So ultrasound, we can see really, really nice detail of the muscle surrounding the shoulder joints and the tendons and ligaments. The problem is, because of the ultrasound doesn't go further, like bone reflects all the sound. So usually we don't see anything below the bone. So because of that, lesions there are in between the shoulder joint and the thoracic cavity, or like just near the axilla, they are really hard to see using ultrasound. Luckily, the majority of the lesions are not located there. So usually ultrasound is going to be, we can see the lesions in the tendon. You can see if there's liquid surrounding the tendon, excessive liquid, which we're going to indicate as inflammation. We can see if the tendon has the normal size and the fibers are correctly distributed. So if they're not correctly distributed, we see lesions, regions that we don't see the muscle fibers or the fibers of the tendons and ligaments, probably there will be a lesion. And so if you find a lesion there, we can stop. And depending in each ligament or tendon that is injured, the clinical treatment is going to be different. And also using like this diagnostic imaging modalities, you can assess the severity of the lesion. So some lesions are going to be more mild, and this is good, and it's going to be easier to treat than a lesion that is going to be more severe and kind of hard to achieve like completely resolution of this disease. And so this is one thing. So if we are still concerned about the osseous lesions in the shoulder joints, one another modality that we can do is CT. This is going to provide a really nice detail of the osseous structures and without any superimposition of the other structures. But if you have a lesion that is we call medial, that is going to be inside the shoulder joint and between the shoulder joint and the thoracic wall, then MRI is going to be the best image modality to evaluate that area. Because MRI also, just like CT, we won't have superimposition. And if you have a lesion that has increased, like there is hemorrhage or has swelling for any sort, we're going to see way better using MRI, and then you can diagnose the lesion.
Once a condition is diagnosed, and let's say you've taken a good look at it and you kind of suspect it's a pretty mild case, the sorts of treatment options available, and this may be a little bit outside of your specialty, but are they often surgical?
Yeah, it depends. Usually when it's mild, it's not surgical. So some treatments, we have to give rest. So for mild lesions, sometimes we can just give a rest, give a break for the animal. Don't allow the dog to do any rough activity or play rough, just being confined. And sometimes you have to use some medication to control the pain, so the animal is going to feel more comfortable. And sometimes this is enough. Some other times you're going to need to pursue physiotherapy and need to pursue another treatment such as shockwave. And just like we do for us when we have a shoulder lesion and other musculoskeletal lesions. So, and then the last case is going to be the surgical approach. That sometimes is the best option that we have, but it usually is the last one that we try to do.
Well, I think one of the great beauties of diagnostic imaging is that it's not really invasive, right? It doesn't require you to open up the animal. And so it's probably the best case scenario when you can use diagnostic imaging to diagnose a milder case that doesn't require any surgery at all, and then no one's ever had to open up the animal to see inside, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's why we the major thing of our service is to provide that, to provide non-invasive ways to try to diagnose lesions that are inside the body, and that the only other way that will be feasible to see is to open the body part and look inside to see what's going on. So that's great. That's the major thing that we do, and that's what we try to provide as best as we can a characterization of a lesion.
What breeds of dogs do you see often that do agility sports?
So the major one is Border Collie, and this is all over the world. In the last agility championship, the from this year actually, the top five breeds that they have there were first Border Collies, the second one was Shelties, and the third one is Miniature Poodle, and the fourth one was Parson Jack Russell, and I think the fifth one was Malinois. Because we got to remember that in agility we have different height classes. So the little Papillon or the little Parson Terrier won't compete with a Border Collie. So they have different heights, and they're going to jump in different heights of jump heights. So, and then Border Collies are just competing in the highest large size category, and the other ones are going to compete in the lower. So usually our patients are mainly Border Collies and Shelties, and sometimes some Jack Russells and some Belgian Shepherds such as Malinois. But it's important to remember and always say that agility is a sport for every dog. So it's for the handler, for the owner, and the dog to enjoy their time.
Yeah, that's really, really great. Let's transition just a little bit, if we can, in the time that we have left, Dr. Giglio, to talk about some of the kinds of what people might call exotic animals that you see in the clinic. And tell us what some of those animals are and whether or not they present any special challenges to you when you're trying to take a look and see what might be wrong and help get a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. So here, and we are very fortunate to have a high caseload of exotics, wild animals in general, and which is not as common in other parts. So this is one of the reasons that I decided to be a faculty here, is because we have a lot of caseload of exotics. So this case may be coming from the wild. So patients that people find in the roads and bring to the hospital, they may come from zoos, they may come from private breeders, and they may come from regular owners that own a different animal besides dogs and cats and horses. So, and then we can divide these animals in, like, you have the birds, we have the reptiles, and we have the pet pockets, which are the little rodents and rabbits. And then we have the big ones that usually we don't see that often here. Sometimes we see here tigers and lions, but for example, it's really rare to see a giraffe, an elephant, a rhino around here. Usually, in this case, we usually go to the animal because it's hard to bring the animal in. Not that we didn't have, like, twice here, I remember that we radiographed elephants, so which is amazing. But usually these species are, usually we go to see these animals, but in our routine here, we have usually smaller exotic patients. And because they are so different, the biology of them are very, very different. The anatomy are very different. And the disease that they most commonly have are very different amongst each other. So the most common challenge is one of the things that I like a lot, is because we have to adapt sometimes the knowledge of prior species or a species that is similar to try to make this connection, make this bridge to try to diagnose and treat that animal for that specific disease that we have in front of you. So that's very, very challenging, and that involves a lot of knowledge because, like I said, the biology, the anatomy, physiology of these animals, they're very different among between them. And so to give some examples, one thing that if the ribs in on us or dogs, cats, horses, they may represent some, may hamper the evaluation of the lungs, the presence of the carapace on the turtles, they will hamper a lot the evaluation of the organs inside, because the bone is gonna, the radiation can pass through the bone, but not completely, we don't have a good idea about the organs that are inside. So when you radiograph a turtle, you're gonna see a lot of stuff, but you're gonna not see other structures, especially structures that are soft tissue. When here, the majority of the Chelonian patients, or the turtles and the tortoise, we go straight to CT, because like I said before, so we don't have any superimposition and you can see way better the organs inside. So you can evaluate the lungs better and the intestines better and the liver and so forth.
When you're talking about a species that you don't have as much opportunity to use diagnostic imaging on, let's say some of these exotic species, let's say we're talking about an elephant, for instance. Now, mm-hmm. is it helpful to be able to reach out to the veterinary community who may already have experience with diagnostic imaging and that specific animal? Are those kinds of exchanges of information available to veterinarians who do the kind of work that you do?
Yes, definitely they are available. We have on ACVR, we have a list that people sometimes put cases to discuss, not just exotics, but cases that they find challenge at some sort. And then they put up to discussion, and we have, in diagnostic imaging, one good thing, and what I like this is to work with all the species and see all the interesting cases from the hospital. But throughout time, you develop some, you prefer to do some stuff, some subspecialties are rewarding, and you feel more rewarding some disease and some species than the others. And that's what, and with this world now that is online, we can reach easily different people and ask for and send the images. And that's the beauty also of, for example, CR or MRI, CT, that we can have the images and send the DICOM images. DICOM is a format of image that is very heavy, the file, but it has a lot of information on it. But it's possible to send this image for somebody else to ask for a second opinion. So this is feasible to do, and we do this when we see the need and we discuss. And one another thing that we can do, that sometimes when you have like small questions about it, one thing that sometimes you can do, like if you are radiographing a bird, different type of bird, and you don't know exactly what is the size of an organ that it has, we can also, if it's a breeder or if it's a zoo, it may have another animal from the same species. So we can try to radiograph and compare. And if you have like a lesion, like in a wing, for example, you can radiograph the other wing to compare. So we can do these simple things that are going to be very helpful. And also with this world that we live in nowadays, we can send images and we can discuss cases really easily.
That's really fantastic and makes the promise of the future that much brighter, right? Because as veterinarians and scientists in general are able to exchange information, as the knowledge is gained by folks like yourself doing a CT scan of a turtle, let's say, that goes into the scientific literature and researchers write articles and that gets reviewed. And then there's more knowledge out there so that professionals like yourself can continue to do this important work. Well, we are just out of time, Dr. Giglio, and I'm really sorry about that, because I really find the exotic topic, very fascinating. And what I hope is in the future that you'll come back and we can talk about it more at length.
Yeah, for sure. It'll be a great pleasure to come back to talk about exotics.
I want to say thank you to Dr. Robson Giglio from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine for coming in and talking to me today, and to Sarah Carey and her staff over at the College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Dana Hill. Thanks for tuning in today. I hope you'll join me again for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Thank you.